It is Friday, August the 4th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, the latest on the Trump-Russia investigations.
Most people know there were no Russians in our campaign. There never were.
U.S. diplomat heads to Asia, the top one with North Korea on his agenda.
The North Korean foreign minister will be there at the same table as Secretary of State Tillerson, so I think he's going to find it hard going.
We'll also have the latest from social media and Eloise at New York's Plaza Hotel. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Here in Washington, a person close to the so-called Trump-Russia probe says special counsel Robert Mueller has decided to use a grand jury as part of an investigation into potential coordination between the Trump campaign, that was last year for president, and the country Russia. The news of the grand jury came out just hours before President Trump went to the U.S. state of West Virginia for a rally. He used the opportunity of being there to downplay the significance of the investigations, often referencing his Democratic opponent in the election, Hillary Clinton.
The Russia story is a total fabrication. It's just an excuse for the greatest loss in the history of American politics. That's all it is. It just makes them feel better when they have nothing else to talk about. What the prosecutors should be looking at are Hillary Clinton's 33,000 deleted emails. And they should be looking at the paid Russian speeches and the owned Russian companies. Or let them look at the uranium she sold that is now in the hands of very angry Russians. Most people know there were no Russians in our campaign. There never were. We didn't win because of Russia. We won because of you.
And now back to the idea of impaneling a new grand jury. VOA's Lori London asked former CIA officer and attorney Jack Rice why the grand jury in Washington, when a grand jury was already impaneled in nearby Virginia, looking into allegations former Trump National Security Advisor Michael Flynn had improper contact with the Russians during the period after Mr. Trump was elected and then took office.
Somebody would impanel a grand jury in order to do a series of things. Typically, you use them when you're ramping up an investigation to subpoena documents, if you needed to interrogate witnesses under oath. And ultimately, and this is generally where you go with this if it's the ultimate conclusion, you use them to seek indictment. So when you're impaneling a grand jury, that generally means you're not slowing down. It means you're ramping up.
So that's what this development basically says to you, is that this investigation is definitely evolving into something very serious? Is this a big deal?
It's a very big deal when Robert Mueller made the decision to impanel a grand jury in Washington, D.C. We know that there was a grand jury in Virginia specifically looking at the issues involving Mike Flynn. If that was the purpose of that grand jury, there would be no reason to impanel a different grand jury to simply look at Mike Flynn. This is not about Mike Flynn, or at least the limited parameters of that previous grand jury. It would be easier just to simply let that one run out. In this case, they've made a decision to have it closer to where all 16 of his lawyers are. And also, I think they're looking at a lot more. This is a big deal.
Does the fact that he has initiated this grand jury mean that he has something, or does it mean that he wants to find out if there is something, from your view?
In my mind, Bob Mueller has made the decision to impanel a grand jury. It's because there's something there. Does that necessarily mean there's enough to indict at this point? Maybe not. But what I do think is there's a kernel of something that needs to be expanded upon, something that has troubled him, something that makes him pause and makes him want to know more and to determine just how far something like that could go. So it is a big deal when you actually take this next step.
It's been reported that Special Counselor Mueller has been hiring attorneys, some of which specialize in international bribery cases. What does that say to you? And also, apparently, he is crossing a red line that President Trump said was a red line, in that he's apparently looking into President Trump and his campaign and possibly family business finances.
First of all, it's fascinating to me that the president actually thinks he gets to set the parameters. He doesn't. No president gets to decide what a special counsel has the right to follow. A special counsel, once you're seated, essentially gets to chase this where it goes. And that's how they work. If you see evidence of a potential crime, you have the right to follow that through. Now, it is interesting to me that we're seeing money. Chasing the money. That's frequently how things would work in this case. What this does suggest to me, however, is they may be looking more closely at Paul Manafort. And the reason I bring that up is because of the millions of dollars that came into his hands from Russian proxies in the Ukraine and his connections and what that may mean. And of course, he was the campaign manager for Trump. So there's a real question there and just how far that goes. Remember, this is all about not the question of whether or not the Russians tried to manipulate the election. They did. What this is about is whether or not Donald Trump and or his associates colluded in trying to help the Russians do that. That's the question. And that's what Bob Mueller is chasing.
We're also hearing about a plan by lawmakers for a bill that would prevent President Trump from firing the special counsel. Obviously, this is a bipartisan effort, too. Obviously, there are concerns that that could possibly happen. What does that tell you on a political level?
That tells me something fascinating. And by the way, that's in both the House and the Senate. And so you're seeing a push in both houses of Congress here. I think it's very clear that Congress is starting to push back. We saw that just recently when they passed legislation about Russian sanctions and essentially forced the president to sign that. That really says that Congress is concerned about this potential relationship between the president and the Russians. They would not have passed this and really shove this down the president's throat if they thought the president wouldn't be the one driving the process. They're driving this, not the president. Their desire and their bipartisan effort to actually limit the president's ability to stop this investigation, frankly, says even more that the president may try to manipulate the investigation itself, not just with what we saw with Comey, not just what we saw with a new FBI director, but what he has said about Jeff Sessions, what he has said about others, what he has said about the Russians, and how he's frankly handled the entire process.
And as former CIA officer and attorney Jack Rice, speaking with VOA's Lori London. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Savor the flavor of African music. I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson returning to Asia starting today with stops in the Philippines as well as Malaysia and Thailand. All of this includes a session of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, in Manila. He hopes to advance efforts to isolate North Korea over the growing threat posed by its nuclear and missile programs. Susan Thornton, Acting Secretary of State for East Asia and Pacific Affairs, spoke with reporters during a telephone conference.
Basically, what we're trying to do is galvanize this pressure and isolate North Korea so that it can see what the opportunity cost is of developing these weapons programs, and that we hope will have the effect of bringing the regime in Pyongyang to the realization that they're just not worth keeping, and that they would enter into a serious discussion with the international community about how to abandon, what the process would be for giving up those weapons, and what could they expect to gain from that decision. So that is very much what we hope to see unfold in the future. As of right now, we don't see any indication that the North Koreans are willing to enter into such a serious discussion with us.
Malcolm Cook, a senior fellow at the Singapore-based Institute for Southeast Asian Studies, tells my colleague Victor Beatty he doubts Tillerson will achieve any breakthrough announcements on isolating North Korea.
The United States certainly encouraged ASEAN, the regional grouping, to not invite the North Korean foreign minister to this year's meeting in line with the U.S. policy you just outlined, but the North Korean foreign minister will be there at the same table as Secretary of State Tillerson. So I think he's going to find it hard going.
Will this be an opportunity for the U.S. to engage in some sort of dialogue?
Even the North Korean foreign minister has already visited the Philippines, who's hosting it, and has announced he'll be there. I think it's highly unlikely that Secretary Tillerson would have a meeting with the North Korean foreign minister, because if that ever came out, I'm sure it would make a big news story. But there is some scope for lower-level contact between the United States and North Korean delegations if the U.S. decides that's a good idea. I'm sure the North Koreans would welcome it.
Well, Malcolm, is there any concern that the U.S. has that members of ASEAN are not enforcing sanctions passed by the Security Council against North Korea?
I think China is the one they focus most of that on, but it's very clear that some Southeast Asian countries and ASEAN members have long-standing and close relations with North Korea, particularly Cambodia and Laos, and so far they have made no visible signs to reduce those. Vietnam also has close historical ties with North Korea, but they have, in step with U.S. encouragement, limited those ties recently, but Cambodia and Laos have shown no signs.
Malcolm, this comes at a time that the Trump administration reportedly is preparing new trade measures to force China to crack down on intellectual property theft and other matters. Is this a way for the U.S. to take aim at China for its support of North Korea?
Acting Undersecretary of State for East Asia, Susan Thornton, was asked this question about overlaps between China's position on North Korea, which the United States and particularly the president have become increasingly critical of, and U.S. trade measures. And she certainly argued that there was no connection between the two. I think the U.S.-China trade problems have been going on for a long time and were a major focus of President Trump's election campaign. So I think the trade frictions and possible U.S. trade remedies would have happened regardless of North Korea.
Malcolm Cook also told VOA's Victor Beatty he expects ASEAN members and China to agree to a framework on a code of conduct regarding maritime disputes in the South China Sea. This comes 15 years after agreeing to such a declaration. However, he doesn't see approval of a legally binding code of conduct anytime soon. And Susan Thornton said the U.S. welcomes such a framework and has called for rapid adoption of an effective code of conduct. Women in the United States are starting businesses at 1.5 times the rate of their male peers, and many of them have gotten help from an author who urges them to strive for collaboration instead of copying the competitive business tactics associated with men. Effective entrepreneurship could help cut the economic gap, they say, between women and men, which the World Economic Forum says could otherwise take decades to close all around the globe. VOA's Jim Randall reports that experts say more than one-third of U.S. businesses are headed by women, and they expect that percentage to grow.
For a growing number of people who work outside of traditional company settings, getting temporary daycare and finding a quiet place to work are big problems. Entrepreneur Nicole Dash sees those problems as opportunities and opened a company called Playwork or Dash.
I like the Zabel on the table.
That watches kids while parents work or meet clients.
So there's lots of flexibility. It's quality childcare when they need it. And you can't really find that anywhere else.
Dash says women start businesses to find a better balance between work and family, more independence and control of their schedule, and of course, to make money. The author of Women Rocking Business says females are starting 1,200 U.S. companies a day and generating $1.4 trillion in sales a year. In a Skype interview, Sage Levine says characteristics associated by our culture with women may be just what is needed for a successful business.
Women, I found in the course of training, entrepreneurs really, really thrive when we do business from a place of collaboration rather than competition, empowerment rather than power over, and a place of generosity rather than urgency. And of course, this works for a lot of men too.
The Small Business Administration's Bruce Purdy says changing laws helped women start many more businesses. Women could borrow money based on their own creditworthiness rather than relying on husbands, fathers, or male relatives. That brought huge changes to the economic landscape.
In 1970, there were only 5% of businesses in the United States that were owned and operated by women. Today, it's roughly 35%.
Yellow words.
He says the number is likely to grow as women start all kinds of companies, particularly in service businesses like daycare, doctor's offices, home care, and education. Jim Randall, VOA News, Washington.
And now it's time to find out what's trending on social media. Here's International Edition's Andrew Palchevsky.
Today, let's take a look at the good and the bad of social media, starting with an app that's causing concern about bullying among teenagers. It's called Saraha, which in Arabic means honest or candid, and it was originally designed as an app for people to constructively criticize one another, particularly for employees who anonymously leave feedback for their employers. Well, you can imagine how this story went. The app became popular not just in the Middle East where it was launched, but all over the world, including here in the U.S. And it quickly became popular among teenagers who are using it to leave anonymous comments about each other, many of them mean. There's concern now among parents that the app could cause teens emotional distress or even cause them to self-harm. Now, this isn't the first time an app has been used like this. Past apps have allowed anonymous criticism, but they've pretty quickly faded in popularity. Many are hoping the same holds true for this app. Meanwhile, the creators of the app have yet to address these bullying concerns or if they're going to implement any changes to keep people from bullying one another. And a case out of Norway is showing how social media deception can actually be used for good, in this case, to call out racism. It started this past week when a man named Johan Sladovic decided to post a picture appearing to show six women on a bus wearing burqas to an anti-immigration Facebook group. Now, when he posted that picture, it drew outrage from group members, prompting hundreds of comments about how burqas should be banned and immigration should be curtailed. But here's the thing. That photo that he posted, it wasn't actually a photo of six women in burqas. It was a photo of six empty bus seats. The silhouettes of those bus seats made them look like burqa-wearing women, but the seats were empty. Once Sladovic revealed the joke, the post went even more viral as it spread across the internet. He said it exposes hatred hiding in plain sight on social media, but it also shows how people online often comment and share content without being critical or taking a look to see what it actually is.
That is International Edition's Andrew Palchevsky. You can follow Andrew on Twitter at APAL. I'm there as well at VOA Norman, and our program, International Edition, can be found at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
Rocks are hoisted and then smashed and pounded into dust in hopes of finding gold in a far north town of Ivory Coast next to Burkina Faso. George Gu Gambaji of the Bundiali region says illegal gold mining is on the rise. The lure of gold is tempting workers from other jobs, like laborers in the agriculture industry. And illegal mining not only pollutes tributaries, it opens the door to illegal migration. But big companies like Randgold Resources have permits to mine and discovered 260,000 ounces of gold for $121 million last year. Company director Bodil Ndiaye says illegals take over the land the company has permits for and pool their concessions. For individuals, a gram of gold can fetch $21 in Ivory Coast. In Burkina Faso, you can get $51 a gram. Government crackdowns on illegal mining have not worked, discouraging international investors to the area. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Eloise, the story of a six-year-old troublemaker who lives at the Plaza Hotel in New York, is a beloved children's book, the first of a series of adventures about the precocious little girl. Well, there is a show now at the New York Historical Society looking at the creators of the series, author Kay Thompson, who died in 1998, and illustrator Hilary Knight, who's very much still alive at 90. Jeff London reports.
For generations of children, Eloise is a favorite.
I'm Eloise. I'm six. I'm a city child. I live in the Plaza.
I met 10-year-old Annie Clark at the Plaza Hotel. She was dressed like Eloise in a black skirt, white shirt, pink sweater, and a red ribbon in her hair.
I think that I do kind of relate to her because she lives in New York City. I can be mischievous sometimes, but not always like her.
Eloise was the brainchild of the multi-talented Kay Thompson, born Kitty Fink in St. Louis, who at various points in her life was a radio personality, a vocal arranger at MGM, and a popular cabaret performer.
Kay Thompson, Kay Thompson.
Hello, hello. So much.
Thompson amused her friends with the voice of a little girl called Eloise, and one of those friends thought the character might make a good children's book. She lived next door to a young artist named Hilary Knight and introduced the two. Knight says he and Kay Thompson hit it off.
She was the most fantastic, interesting, funny, tough lady. She was incredibly talented, and I never had so much fun in my life.
They ended up working on four books together. Eloise has an absent mother, a close relationship with her nanny, her dog Weenie, her turtle Skipper D, and the staff of the Plaza Hotel, where she skibbles about and makes a lot of mischief. Jane Curley, the exhibition's curator, says Eloise became part of the cultural zeitgeist.
She landed at the Plaza in 1955 in the midst of the staid Eisenhower era, when role models for women were June Cleaver and Donna Reed, and all of a sudden, here's this wild, irrepressible six-year-old rushing around, barging into things, getting into trouble, and she struck a chord.
Eloise, Eloise, who is the little girl who lives at the Plaza in New York?
That's me, Eloise. I'm six. I live on the top floor.
Eloise struck such a chord that Curley says,
the Plaza was flooded with six-year-olds looking for Eloise, coming in and saying, is Eloise here?
Which they do to this day, says Plaza concierge Hatsumi Komiali.
And I also tell them to check the elevator. If the elevator comes down really, really slow, that means she did it again, that she pressed all the buttons.
Children visiting the Plaza can have an Eloise tea in the Palm Court with pink cotton candy, go to a store with all kinds of Eloise merchandise, and even stay overnight in the Eloise suite on the 18th floor, designed by Betsy Johnson. It's a riot of pink, and each guest has a personal experience, says the Plaza's PR director, Ariana Swerdlin.
And whenever you come in, Eloise writes you a note.
The irony is that Kay Thompson never thought of Eloise as a children's book. Hilary Knight points out its subtitle is A Book for Precocious Grown-Ups, about a little girl who lives at the Plaza Hotel.
To her dying day, she said it was not a child's book. It offended her, you know, that people considered it that.
Curator Jane Curley agrees.
She didn't like children very much, and she would waltz into Doubleday's and pick up stacks of her books out of the juvenile section and plunk them down in the grown-up section and then walk out.
The exhibition's centerpiece is a large portrait of Eloise that Knight painted for Thompson's birthday.
There's Eloise standing there looking like English royalty.
Curley says the painting hasn't been displayed for 57 years. Thompson donated it to the plaza where it hung in the lobby, but it was stolen on the night of the Junior League ball in 1960.
Walter Cronkite announced on national TV, Eloise kidnapped from the Plaza Hotel. Kay offered a reward. There was a great amount of excitement, but the portrait failed to show up.
2 years later, Knight got an anonymous phone call telling him the portrait was in a dumpster on the east side. He picked up the damaged painting and put it in storage, where it's been till it was restored for this exhibit. But the mystery remains. Who took it?
I strongly suspect that this was Kay Thompson's best stunt ever. She was tired of Eloise. It was 1960. She'd taken the three books out of publication and only left the original book in publication. So to have the portrait disappear was a great exit.
But visitors to the New York Historical Society can enter the world of Eloise through October. For VOA News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
It's really interesting that the writer of the books didn't want to keep all of them out there. Amazing. Quite a fine story if you haven't read them. Blue Boy isn't quite as blue as he once was. That's right, he's going off to be restored. It's an 18th century painting by Thomas Gainsborough. It's been at the Huntington Library in San Marino, California for a number of years. They say they just want to revitalize the color and shore up the canvas, and it'll be back on display. I've seen it many times. It's worth the trip. Thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Zainab Abdul-Rahman, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a super Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has partnered with the United Nations Foundation's Girl Up campaign, Intel Corporation, Google, and other partners to lead the third annual Women in Science Girls STEAM Camp to enable girls to study the science, technology, engineering, arts, and design, and mathematics fields. This year's two-week camp is taking place in Malawi, following a 2016 camp in Peru and a 2015 camp in Rwanda. Almost 100 high school girls from six African countries, Malawi, Rwanda, Uganda, Liberia, Tanzania, Zambia, and from the United States, have convened for a two-week program to increase their skills in the STEAM fields. In addition, the program is designed to increase the campers' leadership skills and networking opportunities. The curriculum includes coding, app development, engineering, robotics, micro and molecular biology, and satellite mapping. Throughout the duration of the camp, the girls will share their diverse, multicultural experiences and perspectives, forming friendships and connections that will help them to develop both personally and professionally. It was my first time seeing a diverse group of girls who barely knew each other, empowering each other, not because they are best friends, but because they realize they have one common feature. They are all girls and want each other to be successful, wrote a young counselor from the 2015 Rwanda camp. The U.S. Department of State created the program to empower women and girls in the STEAM fields, help overcome the gender imbalance in those fields, and to prevent and respond to gender-based violence. The Department of State believes that education of women and girls, including expanding opportunities in science and technology, can help create a safer, more prosperous, and secure world by promoting economic growth and enabling women to drive innovation. During this time of rapid technological development, providing women and girls with access to high-tech resources, like-minded peers, impactful business connections, and inspiring mentors will empower young women to enter the STEAM fields. Women in both developing and developed countries represent tremendous promise for economic growth and prosperity, President Donald Trump recently said at a Women's Entrepreneurship Finance event in Hamburg, Germany. When more women participate in the workforce, the world economy will grow, and millions of people will be lifted out of poverty. Empowering women is a core value that binds us together.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.